Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts.
Dusain.
Jonah Falcon.
The Christy. Which one of us is replacing whom?
Who's the guest?
Chris is supposed to replace
Phil. I do as
Phil.
So,
Chris, you have to channel your inner Phil.
So, who do I DDoS then?
Well, Jonah, obviously, because he's replacing Dan.
Yeah, true.
I am.
Hello, and welcome to episode number 288 of the Polycast. I am Dusain, welcoming you and reminding you of the true civilization game adage that if you see something, slay something. Joining me, our regular host, Makalua.
I had coffee and I'm actually somewhat awake-ish. Which Imagine is about to yell at me because it's how many hours earlier?
Imagine?
I've been awake for a little too long. I had coffee. I look, I see, it's empty. Dan, go get me a coffee.
Oh, that's where he is.
Right on it, sir. That's how he talks.
We also have guest co-host, the Chris D.
Oh, hi. I've been awake probably far longer than anyone else here. I also just came back from the shop, so yeah, I'm full of groceries.
And Jonah Falcon.
This is a very strange version of my podcast right now, but I'm on the West Coast. I woke up at 7 a.m.
Me too. I blame you.
The thread brought up by Ben J. Spurs, where he notices the people playing the game of the month over on Civ Fanatics. So many other people go to war really early, and from what he can tell, there's like nothing but advantages from us based on the fact you gain early promotions, you can expand without building settlers of your own, either by taking cities or stealing settlers. Yay, gotta love doing that. And crippling your opposition. Saying he used to enjoy peaceful playthroughs, but the advantage of early wars are really too great to miss out on.
I have a post on this thread, but I want to expound a little bit on this. Because of the way that Civilization VI combat works, most of the bonuses that you get is from additive value rather than multiplicative value than it was in Civ V. And because of this, more cities equal more yield. You can also get free eurekas and inspirations from taking a city, depending on what the city has. For example, if I only have one sea resource and a city I take, I'll have another free resource, and I can just get a free boost to celestial navigation just for having the city. So there's a lot of bonuses just taking cities because of the additive way it works. I've also been a recent convert toward the build encampments ASAP ethos. Because the AI does not know how to handle war against great generals with five or six swordsmen or horsemen and a battering ram. They don't know what to do with a battering ram. This is something I didn't realize until later. But combat strength is calculated through absolute value difference, not percentage difference like it was in every other Civ game.
Yeah.
And this means that if you can have the ability to have 10 or 15 strength over another Civ, you are not going to have a problem taking them over. This is why classical war is pretty damn good, because if you can get at least one great general, two if best, and have swordsmen going and have that being boosted by a great general, it's much more powerful than ancient cities or classical cities. Even a deity can handle. Battering rams, you want to use them before they go obsolete in the modern. Can't be boosted by a great general, which is one problem. You can have like a bunch of great generals, but without the battering ram looking around with no boost, except for maybe the plus one movement boost and mercantilism with logistics, they're kind of slow to move around and get to the other cities.
Well, that's why you get your horsemen all the way up to the fourth level, right? And then it'll just drag that battering ram everywhere.
Yeah, and that's great. There's that promotion that actually lets you move the battering ram for movement. If we're going to talk about horses, there's nothing between the classical and the industrial.
I think we're talking early war here.
Well, it does count for early war because they're the only horse unit you can really reliably use at the beginning of the game. They're best in the early game because that's when you actually have strength, and compared to the Renaissance when you don't have that kind of strength because horsemen fall out pretty quick.
Especially because they're the plus seven over the heavy chariots.
As a turtling player, I tend not to be that aggressive.
can even like do a relatively early rush, even with just several archers, because once you get those first two promotions, you're adding plus 12 to 25. You're attacking with 37 range strength, which means they're hitting warriors really hard if they're unpromoted. Yep, swords, they're still doing pretty okay against them.
Yeah. And, you know, in melee, you still have the plus 7 as well with the battery.
Battle cry.
Yeah, that one. As soon as you have the bonus over another civ, you should definitely go for it because of that absolute value, combat strength. The difference between 20 and 40 is the exact same as 40 and 60.
I don't get aggressive unless I have swordsmen and no one else does. Then it's on.
I don't get aggressive unless I have archers, and I don't really care what anybody else has.
I don't use archers. Yeah.
Maybe it's just the fact that I'm playing on lower difficulty or all the mods I have. I just tend to rush with like about 5 or 6 archers and a scout. Ideally, the scout will have been promoted to ambush by that point, so he can actually survive camping out at the city.
Yeah, I like using a scout just to make fun of the AI because they keep losing all their cities to scouts.
Well, here's the other thing. I will early attack city-states if I haven't met any other civs, because you can't have any warmonger penalty if no one knows you're there yet.
Well, you also don't really get that much in the ancient era anyways. So.
I've also found taking city-states relatively early on to be a bit of an issue, because pretty much for the first, you know, 20, 30 turns, they could just spam out units like no tomorrow because they have nothing else to build.
Yeah, but a few archers will take care of that spam.
Well, yeah, you'll need probably a fair few, and it might be a bit of a grind to get a city-state early. Suppose depending on its positioning and if it's a good city, or if it's, you know, a terrible city-state bonus that you wouldn't really want suzerain anyway.
Yep. I'll attack a city-state if they have the resource I want.
Yeah, it depends on resource and their bonus.
Also a lot more aggressive if I'm playing with island continents, fractal islands.
Yeah.
Because if you get a good navy going, it's almost too easy just to take coastal cities.
Oh, it's too easy, period.
Yeah, the AI still does not know how to handle anything naval.
Well, also, if you're up on deity, they also fast-tech themselves out of the ability to produce a navy.
Yeah, they go straight to friggin' caravels. Yeah. Yep.
In general, though, when is the best time to do your war? Do you think that it's the early game, or do you think it's the mid-game, or do you think it's the late game? I personally think it's the early game.
Well, it's a bit of both, depending on who your neighbors are.
Yeah, it's dependent on your neighbors, who you
and
are.
And how close they are.
Yeah, and your position. Like, if the capital's within 10, 11 tiles, you know, I'm rushing them, getting it out of the way. It means more room to expand, it gets someone out of the way, and you get that early jump as well as just kind of saying, this is my back garden.
Also, depends on the difficulty level, I would say.
I also personally think that takes less resources to take cities in early game than later game.
Well, depends.
But once the walls go up, it slows you down a bit. Even when you have archers, like archers will still take a fair or a few turns to grind through that 50 defensive strength.
You can take down walls in 2 melee hits if you have a battering ram next to it.
Yep.
Maybe it's just me. I've never actually built a battering ram or
something. You need to learn. You need to try that out and figure out just how f***ing broken battering rams are.
I personally don't think battering rams are useful at all. I will just wreck everything with
melee
archers.
Units, and it's only ever going. I'm pretty much going at ranged with like maybe 1 melee unit. I'm not building huge carpets of melee units unless I'm the right civ and in the right situation, sort of thing.
I just finished an immortal game with only 5 eagle warriors that ended up being muskets. I finished 8 civs before BCs were over. I had 3 great generals, which gave me plus 15 strength. I had 15 from the luxury thing. I got 4 from oligarchy. I had 7 attack from the battle cry. Didn't really matter that my combat strength was 55 from the musket man. I had over 40 from just the bonuses. And I don't think that great generals should stack, but they do. So
yeah, they probably shouldn't stack.
So since they do stack, as soon as you get more great generals than your opponent, then you should really attack because of the absolute value of how combat works.
And for those wondering, the absolute value difference for a one-shot kill is about 28 combat strength, give or take.
I guess it's just different. Most of my tactic is just starting to be an archer rush. I've never really gone for the early encampment into generals all that much, probably because the civ hasn't been the right civ for it.
Yeah, it kind of depends on your civ, too. Even if you attack something that's equal strength, that's still about 50-50. It is all based on the relative.
You know, you're all warmongers, and I'm denouncing you.
Nah. So,
look, in the early game, you have to acquire cities one way or the other. Sometimes that's by putting them down, sometimes that's by stealing them.
Yep, or stealing
settlers. You're about to have magic swords in your face.
But it sort of depends. I mean, the comment about you can get Eurekas and stuff like that is entirely legitimate to let some cities hang out if you know that they're going to get stuff that you wouldn't normally get.
Early war is pretty much it. You can only really get a good from it.
Yeah,
it's not going to be bad.
Well, more cities has always been, or at least supposed to be better. Civ 5 kind of put a kibosh on that.
Yes.
But with the district system, more cities is better, except that the districts shouldn't be spammable like they are.
Yeah. If you have an opportunity to have 10 or more combat strength over your opponent in the early game, then take advantage of it, because the AI will also do that instead on you if you don't.
Well, the AI may just show up to visit you anyways.
Oh, God. Yeah. Don't talk to me.
Suiciding warriors. They suicide right into your capital, and then they don't make more warriors. That's the best part about the AI, right?
All I'm going to say is three words. Bullshit joint war.
Yeah.
Miser's is the next topic. When haggling over price for various commodities, do you try to get the very last gold coin before the other party rejects your offer? Do you sometimes take a lower price because you couldn't be bothered haggling too much? And do you sometimes think it might be better not to squeeze them for too much so they've some left over to work with against one of your maybe stronger enemies? Here's the thing. I seldom ever haggle with the AI. I just say, yeah, whatever. Just go away. I'm doing my thing here.
I mean, most of the time for me, it is just say, what do you want? And it's either I just take one quick look and it's like, yeah, sure, whatever, here, take it. If it's relatively early game, I'll probably try and get them for as much as possible because, you know, I could need that extra GPT, or I could need those 10 extra gold to buy something or to build something. Once it gets to mid game and gold is just flowing out of every orifice, I'm just like, eh, whatever.
Well, I'm not too exact with the deals, especially since the AI tends to dislike me anyway because of early war. Most importantly, the peace deal user interface is not very friendly with sorting out the amount of GTP or whatever I'm going to use, so I just don't bother. So
GTP always adds 10 at a time, and I think gold adds 100 at a time or something, unless you specifically go in or type in. You're very meticulous about exactly how much is in there.
Why can't the game find that out for me?
Yeah, I just keep clicking until they give me everything.
Yeah, that's a lot of clicks. Why can't the user
Depends on their gold per turn.
That's why I'm just not exact about it. And also, I will accept deals that are very lopsided against me if I intend to attack that Civ later anyway.
You're such a backstabber.
Makes it more powerful. And then they use my luxuries, they use my gold per turn, or whatever the hell I'm going to trade over them. And then I reap the benefits by loaning out my spare luxuries. I mean, that's how loans work, right? I don't know. I think that's economics 101.
If I'm going to do a deal with you, I'm going to demand two of your cities along with it.
Yep.
Hey, I can just not take that deal.
Yeah.
If the user interface was better, maybe.
Well, I think part of the problem is that there's a couple of problems in the trade, at least for the switch from Civ 5. One is that the AI, for some reason, overvalues luxury for luxury deals. They'll buy your luxuries, but even if you try and do a lux for lux deal as a friend, they freak out even if they have
copies.
They won't
do it. I don't understand why they won't do that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mess. Even if you're totally friends and allied, they get a little weird about it.
Okay, so we're talking about AI now. Let's ignore AI. Let's talk about multiplayer games when you're haggling with actual other people.
Yeah, well, if you're friends and allies, you're going to trade the lux for luxury. You're going to go one for one.
Because that's the common sense thing to do.
Yeah.
But do you haggle over the finer points? That's the question.
Depends on if it's cooperative or not. I mean, if you're allies...
No, let's not do allies. Let's just do competitive here.
Oh, competitive? Well, screw them.
You're on the other side of the world, so a long war isn't going to help you. Let's say you're on either side of the world and you're starting to haggle over a trade.
If they're on the complete other continent, then maybe it might make sense because of the whole luxury distribution on the various continents. It might be worth looks for trade. Probably wouldn't do any cash trade, if only because everyone is going to have a different idea of what's worth what when it comes to cash.
Yeah.
Like if you're just going to start squeezing me, then I'll just say, well, no.
Then you get nothing.
I'm not trade with you. Well, then they won't get anything either.
Yeah. Like you get nothing. Too bad.
You'll get my naval force at your coastal city. That's what you get.
No, because that pushes into the demanding stuff side of things. So in that case, it sort of depends on whether or not they're looking for a fair trade or not. But even if the AI, if they pop up and say, oh, I'll give you some of this for that one luxury, I'm like, eh, sure, whatever. Not really a big haggling sort of thing. Even though you can, because at different points in the game, the AI will value a single luxury that you could sell them very, very differently.
I don't know. Like, I'm just going to loan out all my luxuries to the AI so they get big and then I take them.
Well, that's the thing. You loan them all your luxuries. They get really, really big. Then they declare war on you because they're big. And all of a sudden they have no luxuries, so they're going to get rebels everywhere.
Yeah, that too. Mm-hmm. They're very smart that way.
Smart in air quotes.
SMRT.
SMRT.
Yes.
There's about four pantheons that I think are good. And number one, I personally like Lady of Reeds and Marsh's one, the plus one reduction on marsh and oasis and floodplains, because those lands are generally ever...
useless.
Generally, they're not useless at all. They're the opposite of useless.
In fact, they're
so good unimproved that you don't improve them, and then you just get free hammers on it.
Well, you always improve floodplains. Because you can.
Well, floodplains. But marshes and oasis is, which I don't even think the oasis can be.
Nope.
No. So, but our marshes, leave the marsh there, get the hammers on it, get it on the oasis. That's very good.
Get to the mid or late game and, you know, your production is ramped up through the industrial zones. Then you can chop them down, get massive food boost, and replace it with a neighborhood for super housing, for example.
Or if it's part of your farm network.
Yeah, I will say, under the right circumstances, God of the Sea is insanely powerful.
Yep.
Under the right circumstances.
It's nice, but it's not as good as it was in Civ 5, because you have the builder charges. And most of the time, those resources are bonus resources, not luxury resources, like crabs and fish.
Oh, so, keep in mind, though, the latest patch changed out sea-based resources to be separate from land-based, which means there are more plethora of them.
Yeah, you now have more whales and luxuries out there. They no longer count towards your continent's luxury distribution.
Yeah, but the point is to still the builder charge. Now, I think it's still...
Well,
I think
in fairness, the builder...
God of the Sea is still really good, but it's probably not early priority.
A builder with multiple charges is better than what used to be. You have to build a single workboat for every resource.
Yeah, well, that's far better.
Yeah.
Well, okay, if you put it that way, yeah.
I've also been always partial to God of the Open Sky, even since Civ 5.
Basically, all of the pantheons, they give you basically a flat resource that's decent and can be plentiful, depending on the lay of the land, are great. That's why you have Open Sky, God of the Sea. Hunt, maybe not so much.
Goddess of Festivals and Oral Tradition, for me, I like the concept of both of them, but the combinations of Goddess of Festival and Oral Tradition don't necessarily go together. Like, I'll usually get some banana, but it's got cocoa and coffee, so that it's like, okay, well, I could either go Oral Tradition for the bananas or Goddess of Festival for the two luxuries. It's some combination that doesn't always go together.
I will say this, though. Bananas are always metric crap ton of them when there's jungle, so I'll usually go with Oral Tradition.
Well, yeah, if there's a ton of bananas, then sure.
You need to be in really kind of really dense jungles to get a lot of them.
Yeah.
I think the problem with festivals and tradition is that they're just so arbitrary in what it's promoted where. I mean, Goddess of Festivals, it's like just kind of food and drink and a bit of tobacco and incense.
Yeah, but see, if it was banana, citrus, cocoa, and coffee, and maybe tea as one group, then that would be the jungle-based stuff.
Then wine, incense, cotton, dyes, silk, and spices in the other one.
Yeah, it would be more the desert slash floodplain slash...
plains, that sort of thing, yeah. So basically add food to the plains ones, add culture to the jungle ones, for example.
Yeah, it's just how they chose to split them up.
The fact that it's split when it used to be one in Civ 5, it was just plantations, period.
Now, here's the thing. The AI always goes for fertility rights.
Yeah, I don't know why.
There's two others that I think are very powerful. That is the God of the Forge and Divine Spark, and not so much fertility, right? God of the Forge gives you the 25% extra bonus on ancient classical unit production, which really helps your early warmongering.
But that's it. Tying into our first discussion, though, I mean, if you're not going to be an early warmonger, then you're not going to bother.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's if you thing, are, yeah. that's a really
Plus,
good one.
I also think you all the long term, so that's usually why I don't bother with God of the Forge, even if I am doing early mongering.
What if I'm going to do upgrades?
The other thing about Forge is that if your kind of landmass has, you know, some of those luxuries that add points of science, or you're near scientific city-states, you're probably not going to want Forge, because you're probably going to plow through ancient and classical era and obsolete those units that you're not going to get the benefit from.
Well, you could always choose not to take the next tech until you're done building.
Yeah, that's the thing. Potentially, yeah, you can deliberately delay your tech progression, but it comes to a point where you kind of have to.
Yeah, but then you're ready to upgrade.
Yeah. Depends.
I will go after stone circles, and if I do that, I usually get the upgrade in religion that allows you to purchase actual buildings with faith.
Jesuit education?
Then it becomes really powerful to have massive amount of faith coming in. I mean, I noticed in the notes that people were a little bit down on the
faith. Some people think faith sucks.
Some people do. They're just doing it wrong. Well, you can also buy great people with faith, too.
Yep.
Yeah, which makes Divine Spark pretty good because it does give you the extra great people per turn on holy sites and campuses and theater square.
Wasted on holy sites.
Yeah, well, once you get your profit, it's done.
It is highly rated on a particular thread, and I do think that it is good, especially if you're going to go for a culture game. Certainly gets those early works up going. Well,
to me, I would have had it more for the scientists. I find this like there tends to be too many writers and whatnot, especially if Russia's in the game, and there's just too many of them out there, or you never will get them.
Well, yeah, I mean, Divine Spark is the ultimate. I don't really have any of these land-based things in sufficient numbers.
Yeah, I have nothing better to
pick. You don't go after religious settlements, do you?
No, God.
They always add in a couple pantheons that are just, why did you bother? Like, religious settlements.
Because the other ones that you want aren't available.
Once tried God of War. It was okay.
No, God of War is with the awesome. Bars. Especially in the early game.
Especially if you whack someone who's, what's it called, much lower than you, too.
Well, it doesn't matter about the you own part. It's just within range of a holy site.
So technically it's a holy site.
Yeah, so somebody goes and they're going and planting holy sites because they want a religion. You pop off God of War, go crush them, get a bunch of faith, and buy the prophet out from underneath them.
So how about the food bonus pantheons like Goddess of the Hunt?
It depends on where you are. If I'm playing Russia in the tundra, I want that.
I'm not going to bother with extra food unless you actually get a massive bonus out of it, because it's just going to start getting housing capped. Why don't you just get other yields instead?
Okay, hold on. You get the early food to get the higher pop to work the higher production.
I'd much rather have it.
If you started around tundra or plains where food isn't great and you don't have many food bonus resources, it can help.
If your land really, really, really helps for a specific pantheon, it's good.
I mean, even an extra 2 food in most of your cities will be okay. It's similar to a granary if you don't have all that much as it is, like if you're filled with hills and woods.
So here's the controversial one, and I know a lot of people debate this one. It's Goddess of the Harvest. Some say it's really good for the late game, and it's not something that's going to help you very early. You have to wait until late in the game when you really get big bonuses.
Yeah, it sort of depends.
Even then, it's like, early game, it's what, 30-40? You can do pretty similar with some of the other ones, because you're not going to be chopping like every turn. You're probably not going to be chopping every turn, because you're thinking about later on. And even later on, it's still only maybe about, what, 200?
Yeah, it sort of depends. Like, if you, say, have a crap ton of jungle around, you're going to be harvesting it anyways. Unless you're going for chicken pizza.
Chicken pizza or Brazil. Or Congo.
Yeah, so if you're neither of those, then you're probably going to be harvesting a fair amount. So.
Although, if you're going to be harvesting, the other toss of, wouldn't you want to just take Sacred Path and just keep them around? They're only a benefit. They're basically 3 or 4.
Oh, yeah, they're usually
2-1 to start. If they're a hill, it's 2-2. It's okay. They're probably there more as the expansion or the later pop will work those tiles. But if you also don't have much else early on, even like a hill cocoa in Rainforest is beautiful early game.
That's the best part about most of the pantheons. It sort of depends on what you have.
I don't know why they don't have Monument of the Gods go through deeper into the game, because all it does is ancient and classical.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically Corvée. And I suppose if you have Corvée and Monument of the Gods and your Egypt, you could pump out monuments. But
and you go for the government autocracy.
Yeah, that too.
The problem is that it still seems like too brief. Maybe go into industrial.
Medieval.
But actually go all the way into industrial and stop there. I mean, you don't need modern information, but still.
Well, no, because there's other civs that have bonuses for those areas, but
it's basically almost like the thing is the pantheon is the old marble boost. And no one ever really thought about the old marble boost because it was so specific. And
yeah, the old marble boost was great.
Yeah, but if you happened to spawn near it.
Yeah.
If you didn't,
then
tough.
Well. Monument of the Gods, there are enough ancient and classical era wonders that are really good. So if you're really worried about getting to a specific one, then eh. But I mean,
Stonehenge.
Unless, yeah. Well, even then.
I'm just saying, the only one that you'd have to really get quickly is Stonehenge, because the AI, for whatever reason, zeroes out on Stonehenge. Yeah. Here's a question for you. What pantheon belief do you like to combo with a religious edict? I mean, not edicts, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I'm like, I got confused here.
If you want to go kind of heavy face and be a big religion player, it's either going to be stone circles or, depending on the lay of the land, one of those holy site adjacency things.
Oh, yeah. If I'm going mass faith, I'm hoping there's that tundra or desert.
Which one is the one that gives you, like, a bonus on a river if you have a holy site next to the river or something?
River goddess.
Like menace.
Yeah. But if you're going specifically for a religious victory, maybe that.
No, because it's only one amenity.
A river as opposed to your adjacencies everywhere else. I mean,
that's not faith, that's amenity.
You can get that early amenity from classical. Go classical republic instead.
Great admirals.
Leif Erikson.
There's really only two that were interesting to me, and it was Leif Erikson for one of them, because
Leif is awesome! Unless you're Norway.
It gives you the opportunity. If you retire Leif Erikson, you can use naval units in oceans, which allows you to use early ships before the Renaissance, caravels, and frigates. Ocean battles without getting the Renaissance, unlike everyone else in the world, and Norway.
Which would be nice, is that quadrines are one range, so... Mm-hmm. What use is being in those ocean tiles when they can't hit?
Well, they can attack galleys who are stuck on the coast.
Don't tend to find the AI building them.
Well, they're going to have something. Well,
just gives you the opportunity to use them before you have to use Renaissance units.
Or you go over to the other continent, if you're on a continent's map, burn down every single city-state that's over there on the coast, and then laugh at the AI.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. The thing with me and admirals is that, generally for me, I'm rushing the mausoleum so I can use all of them twice. And then I've had it where I built the mausoleum and then I've gotten Yi Sun Sin in like 1200 BC and I'm running around with two ironclads.
Yep. Yi Sun Sin, Renaissance era admiral, instantly creates an ironclad with one promotion level. Yes.
Yeah, Rans von Hipper does that with a battleship, although he's a monster.
Yeah. Yeah, but ironclad is like 60 combat strength at a time
When cities will probably have, swordsmen, maybe a knight, so they'll be about 28 to 38 or something like that before districts. So, add the promotion on where he gets more strength. It's even better if you have Yi Sun Sin and you always have Santa Cruz waiting around. Then it becomes an armada, add another 17 strength. You're running around with a 77 strength naval melee unit. Coastal cities crumble.
Well, you also have Gaius Julius, who's the early version of him, creates a fleet out of a military unit.
Yeah,
but at that stage, you're going to be stuck on galleys or quadrines. And
no, but he doesn't vanish. His ability doesn't vanish over time. You just keep him around until you really need it.
Hmm.
Yeah, but I suppose it's helpful if you have him and that you end up getting both Yi Sun Sin and Von Hipper.
Yeah, the bigger problem is that core fleets just aren't really useful.
The 10 extra strength is nice, but at that stage of the game, it's not really going to make all that much of a difference. You're still going to have slow, lumbering fights because you can barely maneuver. And even a galley core, if you're going against a barb quadrine, you're going to have a hard time.
There's another one that I like, is called Horatio Nelson. It only affects melee ships, so not ranged ones. Mm-hmm. It's industrial, so you retired at industrial, but it gives you a 50% flanking bonus, which is nice. If the AI for ships were better, then that would be very nice for naval warfare. But otherwise, if it did work out very well, then 50% flanking bonus, very nice.
I mean, Horatio sounds nice on paper, but plus 50% flanking bonus is one combat strength. Flanking bonus is plus two. Horatio Nelson then makes that plus three.
Yeah, maybe it's not as good as I thought.
If you have the mausoleum of Halicarnassus, it becomes plus four.
Depends on how much of a surround you can get before you actually do it. With Horatio and at the museum, you can get a good surround and jack up that absolute value.
Still good if you have plus five or plus six over the AI, because it can break a stalemate if you're using the same kind of units.
How about Grace Hopper? It's not very fancy, but boom, you get a bonus tech from information.
Tech, yeah.
Well, at that stage of the game, your empire is so big and probably has so much population and enough campuses that you're just looking at the information area and laughing at it because you just click through them.
Unless you're a warmonger who's been devoting all his time to beating up on people.
And then you steal all the other cities and you steal their population and you still have science from all of that.
Sort of depends. A fair number of the Info Era Eurekas are based on, do you have it?
Getting it from a great scientist or spy,
See, personally, I'd go with Rajendra Kloa for an early one. You get 50 gold, but then all military units get 40% rewards to looting.
You're such a pirate. You're such a pirate.
Looting!
I thought it was for naval units only. Because I know Qingxi there, which is the military units get extra for plundering sea trade routes. I've had that one pop twice, and suddenly, you know, plundering trade routes is like nearly 250 a go if they're on water.
Because don't forget you add your policies too for extra pillage power.
Pillage.
Mass pillage.
Overall, like even raiding these things, it's still kind of weird because you can't really afford to not take up whatever great admiral or great general that you get because the big bonus is the combat bonus.
Yeah.
Not really the retirement bonus.
Well, I don't know. Sometimes the retirement bonus.
No, that is absolutely true because there's not enough of a pool to really start dismissing great people.
Well, later ones, maybe.
The earlier ones, you're kind of going through too quick. Might end up through the eras too quickly.
All the great people, you plow through the eras a little too quickly. But if I can, say, manage to snag two Renaissance era people, then yeah, I'm going to burn one. Probably didn't even need the first one.
Zheng will go instantly. Yi Sun and Von Hipper will definitely go immediately. And especially if I can take those units and then combine them with the people such as, you know, Lascarina, Togo, and the guys later on with all that extra promotion levels and experience to get them to promote even quicker. Because pretty much my navy will consist solely of the units I get from the great admirals.
Well, here's the thing. Sergei Gorshkov and Clancy Fernando are basically the coup de grace of your war. It'll be like, oh, by the way, boom, all of them getting a free promotion, and now they're getting bonus combat experience. That's it. The war is over.
Yeah, I shoot you once. I've already got another promotion.
I shoot you once. I promote. I shoot you once. I have extra range. I shoot you once. Suddenly, I defend a lot better. I shoot you once. Your air units can't do anything. Not that the AI uses their units, but that's another topic.
We have artists.
Yeah.
They make things. Some of them are religious, some of them are not religious, and if you're going for culture, grab some great artists. It's so, not like with the great admirals and things where they have specifically different bonuses or things to them. They're all producing art. I mean, just grab one. I don't think anybody really specifically targets them unless you're trying to get the religious art to boost your faith faster.
Or if you're Congo and you get bonuses from sculptures.
Yeah.
Well, aside from the Congo bonuses, Industrial and Modern have 5 great artists, aside from the other eras have 4. So if you're looking for the theming bonus, then you're going to want to make sure to pick up the Industrial and Modern ones if you're actually going to go for theming.
Particularly if you actually want to theme sculptures, because you get 2 of them in the Renaissance, and then you get nothing until Atomic. Again, as is the same with the Admirals, there is not enough of them, there's not enough variety. It's very hard to theme.
And the thing is, each of them provide a lot. Each one we're putting out.
They all fill one museum.
Yeah, except that there's no theming bonus for doing that.
What's wrong with Rodimus Bosch, damn it?
If he's not the first great artist to come out, then you're not likely to get any really religious art. Because, again, people will tech too quickly, they blow through too quickly, suddenly you're in the industrial era, there's very little religious, and once you hit modern, it's gone completely.
For theming bonuses, you kind of have to have them from the same era, right? Civ 5 had way more theming. Civ 6 has... the art looks the same. Go for it.
Most of them tend to have 3 of the same work, whereas a few of them have a different work at the end. For example, Rembrandt has a religious as opposed to 2 portraits.
The new diplomacy rate persons, and is basically a project that someone's doing right now.
Basic pitch here is that you can build a district that generates influence points toward envoys that you can send to city-states.
The district is called the Government Complex, and it includes 3 buildings called the City Plaza, the Senate, and the Parliament. And it provides great diplomat points, as other things do, like religious does great profit points. It gives you a plus one adjacency bonus from the city center, wonders, and commercial hub districts. The city plaza will give one great diplomat point, plus one housing, plus two influence points on city-states, and a one citizen slot. The Senate will increase that amount, but also add gold. And the parliament will also add production. He has a list of 21 diplomats so far who would be great people. He hasn't really talked about what they will do if you use them.
Yeah, and some of the people in that list are not actually diplomats.
I'm much more interested in not the people, but the actual values.
Yeah,
because you get influence points from your government. If you have a bunch of those districts lying around, it's way, way overshadowing.
Way too many, yeah, because, I mean, you get what? It's 1, 3, 5, and 7 from the government.
It's 3, 5, 7, from government.
Well, I think I get 1 from chiefdom, but yeah.
Now, of course, the value doesn't really matter. It can be like you don't even get one on the first level of that building, but then you get one on the second tier.
Maybe 1 from the Senate and 1 from the... I don't know. The bonuses for influence points are kind of a bit absurd, but then again, so in my opinion, is the whole envoy system as it stands. Yeah. But,
well, yeah. Does it mean that you can spam this in every single city?
Yeah, that's what I worry.
Like,
then you end up with so many envoys on the level of the new buffed.
Yeah, overshadows
literally
going for city-state quests, and it overshadows the whole influence on your government. But also, you don't need all those other bonuses. You don't need the housing bonuses. You don't need the gold bonuses and the production bonuses because you're getting all the suzerain bonuses.
Yeah.
In fairness, I can see the point to housing, and it's actually a decent solution for some kind of mid-game housing.
Well, get housing with farms. There's plenty of ways to get housing.
It's at the point where you kind of need it in large numbers, and you need it way before urbanization.
Neighborhoods are going to be completely worthless if you have this.
Yeah, but I mean, you can get an extra, like, maybe 1 or 2 or even 3 housing from us when you don't have to build an encampment to get us. That's the bit I saw, and I was like, that would be nice. Otherwise, this entire thread reeks of the redistricting mod that's on the workshop, which is absolutely crazy and stupid and insane.
I don't think it's a bad idea. It's too much of a blunt hammer. I mean, if it went for subtlety, like instead of adding actual points, maybe add percentages, like 5% or 10% or
15%. Yeah, 5% to your gain, which is kind of like what you have from...
No, but this game is all about additive bonuses, not multiplicative bonuses. Mm-hmm. Haven't you been paying attention?
Well, there are multiplicative bonuses.
Well, there's a couple. Yeah.
But the real meat in this thread is further down.
Hey, we're going to have World Congress again. We want that, right?
No.
Maybe not the World Congress, but I mean, he's suggested several things to make diplomacy not the crap bucket it is right now.
Well, the reason that I didn't read a lot of them is because that requires the AI to be tuned better, and they're not.
Oh, yeah. Of course, I understand this, and good luck with that.
Diplomacy is almost useless because we are winning. They fear us. Oh, my God. What? That they just... why?
Plus, some of those choices are like, you can now choose to trade food per turn. That tiny little piece of a line means that, one, how are you going to trade food per turn?
Yeah.
Food per turn is per city, and that food doesn't even expand to your own empire. How are you going to send food to somebody else from one of your own cities when you can't even do that within your own cities? So you'd have to massively rework food in
the whole
game. You may
even have to have a stockpile somewhere where you can choose to, whenever you harvest something, you can choose to put that food in the stockpile and put it where you want or trade it away or something.
Or you can make it that you can never starve instead. You can have almost no food, but you'll never starve. So some civilizations may completely abandon their farms and just go after knowing that they'll never have to worry about negative city growth.
Yeah, I think you'd have to have farming cities, which don't exist yet.
I think that his idea for vassals is okay, because there is a point where you should just be able to beat up Civ well enough that they can just be your vassal. Ignore all the stuff in Civ 4 that had problems with vassals, but...
Yeah, no, the concept of vassals, yes.
Yeah, sure.
Alliances that can consist of more than 2 civs.
Yeah, that was a weird one.
Yes, please.
Especially since you can name it, which would be hilarious in multiplayer.
Because right now the alliance is just a thing that lasts 30 turns, and all of a sudden it disintegrates almost like it never happened.
Perma-alliance, yeah.
No, permanent alliance is
maybe
fine.
Not permanent, but at least it stays until you choose to end it.
Yeah, semi-permanent.
Just before the end of the game. Oh.
The thing about this entire situation is that the reason I thought we got rid of the diplomatic victory is because that city-state AI is not interesting enough to make a victory condition out of it.
Well, it shouldn't really be based around the city-states. It should probably be more based around civs in general.
Yeah.
The main civs.
Well, I mean, it could be something like have a certain number of envoys at all city-states so that you don't have to be a Caesarian, but at least you have influence with them. Or at least an alliance of enough to say, okay, we're going peaceful now, and if you don't like it, we're going to thump you.
I mean, that's not what's in the thread, but yeah.
The World Congress thing? Yeah, no. It is so non-realistic. Like, I just got voted to lead the UN. Woo, I win diplomacy. What? No, you didn't. Shut up. No.
Yeah, there's a lot of other things that can be done with regards to diplomacy and influence in the game that doesn't need to be massively tweaked like this. They can do other things like, well, fixing the AI and tweaking city-states so that the city-state that's in the back of your empire, completely surrounded by your cities, that no one else noticed until, like, they got a satellite, can't suddenly just be picked off from you because they sent four people there when you had three people there all tame.
The concept of a district for government-related stuff is fine, although everything they've put in there is not, and it obviously shouldn't be spammable.
Maybe capital only. Maybe capital only.
Yeah, capital only.
Yeah.
Or
but isn't that just making the palace all over again?
Yep.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, it's basically giving us a district that is the palace.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. There you go.
There you go. Somebody can burn your palace down. It'd be great.
Exactly. Oh.
Burn your palace down. Maybe you should have severe
penalties.
You should be crippled.
Yeah. And therefore, if you lose your original capital, your palace doesn't automatically move to somewhere else. You have to go build the government.
Build a new palace. And then the city that took it over can be like, I have this guy's original palace. I fixed it up and it's even better than it was. Now I have two palaces.
The problem I have with about this whole thing is that the concept of the district was supposed to be like a mini city. So if the government building isn't in the palace, then that's kind of odd.
Yeah. I don't know. So,
but
yeah,
here's the thing, and historically, we're not going to call it a palace, but the castle was its own mini city.
Yeah, it was separate. Mm-hmm.
And then you had the outlay, so it wouldn't be that different.
Some policy cards should be for certain governments only.
Yes.
I actually agree with that concept, especially for the last level of governments. You go to, say, communism because you want this one policy card from communism. But you actually go into democracy because it's the better government out of all three of them. Because screw the rest. And the same thing for fascism. The only reason I go to fascism is for that Diplo card. That's it.
We're going to have some disagreements here.
Some things make sense to go that way. But, I mean, you can say, oh, well, the government, you can a little bit of this sort of style versus that sort of style and then mix up. And that's fine for, I think, most of it. But the government bonuses are supposed to cover the uniqueness of the government.
Exactly.
That's what it's supposed to do. It's just that there's not that much choice. Like, it'd be cool if when you get to, say, democracy, you can make a choice of uniques. You can say, my unique bonus will be this, or it'll be that. And that way you can have different types of democracies without the policy cards getting too, this should be for this or not.
So toward the original poster, I believe the opposite. I believe that limiting players' options with the cards by making some exclusive to the government is not a good idea. Players already make the government choice based on what types of cards are available in the government and the government's bonus and legacy bonuses. Taking away those certain types of cards are something that I would not support, and people don't like being locked out of options. As you can go to any Civ 5 thread and look for piety versus rationalism.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are some of us who played Alpha Centauri who, when that system worked out just fine. Like, if you're playing Shang, you had to be police state, you know, or Pravin Lal, who was not allowed to have police state, or something like that.
The cards are a big deal.
Yeah.
We're not saying you have to lock all the cards. We're just saying, like, some ones that seem more appropriately to that government, you can only do in that government. Then you still have free reign over other things. Which
let's talk about Liberty for just a second, because in Liberty and Civ 5, you were able to get the settlers out, and then it's kind of worthless to me. I like it a lot more that you're able to have choices every time you have a new civic choice, because that's one of the only good things that are actually historic about governments, that they change every once in a while. It's not like we have Iraq still following the code of Hammurabi.
with the governments the way they are in the game that I kind of dislike is the fact that it's a certain specific fixed layout. Sometimes I want the government for the bonus. For example, as I said before, I wouldn't mind monarchy, but I really dislike it because I'm locked into three military slots that I'm rarely ever going to use. I'm probably going to have one, and it's either the defensive act or it's the logistics policy.
That's the biggest restriction for the governments. I like that restriction.
Yeah, but I'd rather lock in the cards. It'd just be nicer if they maybe freed...
Well, then the Greeks and get that free wild card slot.
Yeah.
You already have hard choices. For example, if you're going to be a warmonger, you're going to want to keep oligarchy bonus and not go to the tier 2 government. And then by doing that, you're losing influence points, you're losing cards if you want to keep that particular bonus. It's not like you don't have hard choices, but locking people out of bonuses is something that is never going to go over well with people. And like I said, you can just go back to the piety and rationalism threads to find out about that.
Well, what if when you unlock the government, as this goes back to what I was saying, instead of the policy cards, because you can leave those generic, what if there's on that tech and maybe sprinkled throughout separate cards, government cards, that can modify the base government bonuses and even possibly modify the card layout? So,
Here's the thing. It could be that you could have a government that speeds research on a specific type of policy. Very small, like 5%, but it still speeds towards it a little bit faster if you really want to make a change. And the thing is, it just sounds like a lot of changing for the sake of changing.
Well, sometimes that's what expansions are for. You want to change things.
That's what your government to go. That's how the laws to make your civilization go better each time you make a decision on your government. That's one of the best things about Civ 6 is this card system. The policies themselves are very neutral.
I mean, conscription. Okay, you can have that under any government. Any government will have conscription. It's not locked to any type of government. Yeah.
But you are. You are locked under certain cards, and that's how you choose your government aside from the bonuses.
What I mean is a democracy conscripts, a fascist government can conscript, a monarchy can conscript. Conscription is not a government-specific type of thing. It's just, we're going to hire more soldiers.
But it's more a case of a monarchy shouldn't have to be militarily focused. A monarchy could also be economically focused, for example. So you should be able to take one or two of those military slots and possibly put economic policies in there, for example.
No, historically, monarchies have been very militaristic.
Yep. allow you to at least let you build your own civ. Stop limiting me. Stop telling me that I can't use these cars because I'm in the wrong type of government. You know, I mean, as long as I can't use a certain economic card instead of a policy card, isn't that enough? Or, you know, getting the specific government bonus, isn't that enough? Why do you have to limit what I have?
That's why I was thinking the options of adjusting some of the base governments. I mean, and it's not about, isn't it good enough? It's like, no, I mean, just because they put out a decent first pass doesn't mean that it can't be improved to be better. Say a monarchy that goes with the Magna Carta. Maybe they lose a military policy slot by accepting the Magna Carta, but gain either a diplomacy or an economic card.
No, because they still were warlike even after, even more so. More crusades after the Magna Carta was signed.
Well, crusade, a little different.
When you're choosing a government, do you look at the bonus or the policy slots more?
It depends.
Bonus can tend to kick in a little bit as well. Like, I'm thinking theocracy if I have a religion, and I want to spam out inquisitors.
No, oligarchy all the time.
Well, not tier one. Tier two. Tier three, it's pretty much, it's just democracy, because you need all those economic slots.
It does depend on the tiers, because...
Unless you're trying to take over the world.
With tier one, that's the thing. With tier one, having all three governments pop up in the exact same civic, there's a choice. Like, right off the mark, you have a choice. Do you want to go economic? Do you want to go war? Mm-hmm. Do you want to, like, hamstring yourself and try and build wonders that somebody else takes from you? Because that's really, you have two choices and then a third option for no reason. But when you get to tier two, they're spread all over the civic tree, and that makes it a lot harder to actually directly compare. Because if you want just to get to the next tier, then you have to take monarchy because you're going to get there first. And then you might be in a monarchy for like 3 seconds while you plow right into theocracy. Or you totally skip it and you're stuck in an old classical republic until you manage to get to exploration because it's so far out of the way and everybody else has been monarchies up until that point. But then when you get back to tier three governments, they're all in the exact same civic line and all have the exact same previous civic. So you do sort of have to make a choice of which one you research first, but they're all right there. And therefore, after you research one and pick it, you can research the other two and take up all the policies.
And that is how you get your cars. Not by the game telling me you can't use it. It's because you research toward the one you want. Don't tell me that I can't use a certain policy.
There's enough of an argument to be made that the governments themselves have their bonuses and their historical bonuses and the different slots to be specifically limiting. But maybe some policy cards shouldn't be directly tied to the government civic itself. Maybe the government civics, or at least the civics that open up the government types, should be a little less specific with certain policy cards. That way you don't have to care about nuances of the fact that this card, gunboat diplomacy, always comes with fascism. Maybe it's a separate civic.
I don't know. It seems to me that the entire policy government thing is balanced. It's like trying to affect change there might disrupt the game a lot. I mean, here's the thing. I wouldn't mind seeing someone do a mod and getting what people think of it. I don't think you're going to see it in an expansion.
You never know. Everything is always open to change.
From when I was reading this thread, there is one thing that made me go, maybe civs, especially the ones that are kind of hurting, might have unique policy cards that wouldn't last for long. But like, for example, you have your triangular trade, which gives normally 4 gold and 1 faith. And maybe there's a civ that could use 4 gold and 2 faith. That could be interesting, I think, to have unique policy cards.
I don't know. I mean, maybe you might have a unique policy for each of the government, or for each of the government that's basically their bonus on steroids, for example. But other than that, I don't know.
Oh, an actual government, that would be way too much. I just think like a card that would be used for like a couple eras.
Well, we already sort of have that. A lot of policies die off because they get replaced by other policies that are better than them.
Yeah.
In the same vein. So there's already sort of that. In the game.
But I'm saying, like, to have a card that you can use that gives you a little bit of extra faith in the example that I gave for a couple turns, maybe, you know, like 50, 60 turns or so.
Yeah.
Reader feedback from the last 3 podcasts. I think there was a lot of reaction to Australia.
Discussion.
Since that was, yeah. Uberfrog said, I particularly appreciate going back to that previously unheard discussion with Topangolin.
Yeah.
About Australia, colonial legacies. It was interesting to hear that the Australia DLC was all just part of his master plan. Hopefully we'll see some new and interesting choices from Firaxis getting around to representing the Native Americans in Civ 6. I really liked, who was the one that when you planted their city that they immediately had this expanded area?
Shoshone.
Shoshone, yeah. I really enjoyed the Shoshone.
Yeah, well, now that's Russia, so meh.
Yeah.
Although I like the Shoshone's Pathfinder, where you got to choose stuff. That actually provided some different mechanic for it. So.
Yeah, you're about to say choice, but that's not.
Yeah, you didn't really get
choice.
That's not
completely true.
You didn't necessarily get extra choice, but you did, sort of. It would be nice if they also didn't do, welcome to, we slapped a name on it because you hated the word native as a group, but we slapped one group's name on it, but then each of the bonuses came from somebody else.
Drew Bell said, I can agree to some of the bonuses of Poland being pretty weak.
Yeah, that's me. So
yeah, that's true.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
So Drew Bell said, shut up.
Well, you can talk about my topic. That's fine. Then.
Oh, you know what? I'm going to say, well, he said.
Yep.
I'd like to provide some love for the Sukiens. I don't know how to pronounce that. As a player who likes to use his trade routes for internal trade, the +4 gold from internal trade routes, as long as you have Sukiens, provides massive utility and purchasing power with gold. I've been playing a game spamming excessive settlers in the early game. And focus on getting internal trade routes for the cities through internal trade routes and building more cities and pumping them up with internal trade routes to get the Sukiens. You said internal trade routes a lot.
Yeah.
In one sentence. A lot.
Because external trade routes pretty much don't exist when you think about it.
You also approve of bring up UI features in the game. You could probably fill 2 hours on that alone.
Well, there's also the whole military card.
Well, we already discussed that just now.
Yeah, we just did that.
Military card getting switched to a wild card. Yep, good.
You guys were saying that Poland wasn't very good for conquering, but I'm just trying to say that I think Poland is one of the best when it comes to peacemongering, I guess.
They're good at both. Just wish that the Hussars didn't go away so quickly.
Yeah, the Sicanese is obviously, it's useful. And you're going to build the market anyways, no matter what you do. Yay. The thing for me is the Poland bonus for the faith on the holy site thing.
So, yeah, I ignore that.
Yeah. It only makes the have even worse decisions on where they place their holy sites.
Yeah, and if the Hussar came in, say, a tech tree that made you go there rather than completely ignore all Renaissance and Industrial era military units, it would be better. And if you could upgrade into it, that'd be even better.
That's a problem shared by a lot of the Civ Unique, so...
Did you know that domestic tourists cannot be found anywhere on the Civilpedia? And so you don't know how you build them?
So apparently he gave us the formula, which was a domestic tourist equals total culture plus the total civic inspiration culture divided by 100. Mm-hmm.
So it's 1% of the culture you've ever generated. Yeah. Which, okay, it would be nice if the Civilpedia said that.
And the visiting tourist is similar to us, isn't it? Is that your tourism over their culture percentage like it was in Civ 5?
I don't know, man. The game doesn't
very tell similar.
You. I know.
It is very similar.
The game doesn't...
Can't you enjoy a little mystery once in a while?
No. There's no such thing in the other victory conditions. You know exactly the values and why you're going to those values. You can calculate those values. Why can't I do it with the culture victory? I looked at the Civilpedia for culture victory today, and it doesn't tell you anything about how you actually get the yields for those two particular things, the domestic tourist and the visiting tourist.
I think it's because the culture victory is so easy that they don't want to tell you because they're going to get it anyway.
No, that's stupid.
That's not going to happen.
They have to make the definitions for this game actually have definitions.
You
have to give definitions.
Yeah.
Please make the definitions better. Please make a better Civilpedia.
Just turn culture victory off and you don't have to worry about any formula. That's what I do.
Then you win science victory because that's where all your formulas are going.
Yep. Or the game can just be better and tell me how to play it.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 441-228-8-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
I think that's going to wrap up the No Dan...
We'll find
episode.
Him eventually.
We know where he is.
He's counting his money. As a teacher.
Uh-huh. All $0 of it, yeah.
Nope. During the summer, yes. Thank you all for listening to Polycast episode 288. I was the Christy, and I was joined by two of the regulars, the two we have left, Mad Jin.
Time for more coffee.
And Mackie, probably also with more coffee.
Team caffeinated.
Mm-hmm. And joined by two other random blokes off the internet, Drew.
Hey, can I be your next user interface guy? Because maybe I can do it a little better.
And Jonah.
Hi, and GamingPodcast.net, the podcast that Dan used to be a part of on a regular basis.
We'll go fetch Dan.
Bye, everybody.
You get to say it's time to dance out here.
Speaking of nightmares.
Speaking about modding, well, not really.
Yeah,
no,
speaking
not really.
Of bad great people.
Speaking of bad segments.
Wow, that's
yeah,
a great,
great artist. Yeah, so.
I have a lot to say about this one.
Okay, well, I'll intro it. Dun, dun, and then we can talk. Let me intro. Okay, so. I actually agree probably with whatever Drusane says, or not, depending on if he says the wrong thing.
I just have one question.
Yeah.
What is Civ 6?
I don't know.
I don't know. It's a game that is kind of good, but could be better. Enough to make the nudes. The nudes.
The we can't put the nudes in.
I stopped for that before that happened.
the notes for today.
You get to end with Drew talking about watching nudes. And...
No, I said nukes.
I heard the animal.
You were trying to say nukes, but it seemed to come out as nudes-ish.
Yep.
Well, nukes are basically nudes. If you look at it in a certain way, yes.
Record date?
August 19th, 2017.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips. Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.